crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Haaretz reported earlier this year that a palatial building dating to the era of King Solomon 3,000 years ago was discovered in the royal city of Gezer. On the second half of today's show, I'll be talking to part-time Jerusalem archaeologist Christopher Eames and his recent visit to Gezer, as well as an article he has written about that subject. Before that, on the first segment of today's show, we'll discuss President Obama's decision to allow an anti-Israel United Nations Security Council resolution to go through the council, breaking decades of precedent set by American administrations. We'll look at some of the possible outcomes from the vote, as well as look at some of the darker motivations behind President Obama's actions. I'm your host, Brett Nachtigall. Welcome to Watch Jerusalem.
The fact is, my administration's commitment to Israel's security has been unprecedented. Our military and intelligence cooperation has never been closer. Our joint exercises and training have never been more robust. Despite a tough budget environment, our security assistance has increased every single year. And just as we've been there with our security assistance, we've been there through our diplomacy. When the Goldstone Report unfairly singled out Israel for criticism, we challenged it. When Israel was isolated in the aftermath of the flotilla incident, we supported them. When the Durban conference was commemorated, we boycotted it, and we will always reject the notion that Zionism is racism. When one-sided resolutions are brought up at the Human Rights Council, we oppose them. When Israeli diplomats feared for their lives in Cairo, we intervened to save them. When there are efforts to boycott or divest from Israel, we will stand against them. And whenever an effort is made to delegitimize the state of Israel, my administration has opposed them. So there should not be a shred of doubt by now. When the chips are down, I have Israel's back.
That was President Obama's speech before the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, or APEC, back in 2012. And those cheers, they were from the Jews in attendance. It sounded good at the time, but what he was saying wasn't true back then. And with this latest, or the latest actions by the United States at the United Nations Security Council, we see that it's not true today. On Friday, just a day or two before the start of the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, the United Nations Security Council voted to pass a resolution that declared Israel's settlement activity illegal. It declared all of Israel's towns in the West Bank as illegal. Now, usually, the United States would vote against or veto any Security Council resolution against Israel like this, but not this time. This is how the Chicago Tribune characterized the vote at the UN on Friday. They write, in a striking rupture with past practice, the United States allowed the UN Security Council on Friday to condemn Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem as, quote, a flagrant violation of international law. The decision to abstain from the Council's 14-0 vote is one of the biggest American rebukes of its longstanding ally in recent memory, and it could have significant ramifications for the Jewish state, potentially hindering Israel's negotiating position in future peace talks. Given the world's widespread opposition to settlements, the action will be almost impossible for anyone, including Trump, to reverse. Now realize this, while Israel's relationship with the United States is set to improve, it looks like that under a President Trump, this damage done at the United Nations cannot be undone. It cannot be undone. even though there's a new president coming into power. Now, to explain this, I'd like to just listen to Alan Dershowitz as he spoke to CNN on Thursday before the vote.
Alan, I spoke with you earlier, and I think you're looking at this question this way. You don't want President Obama to tie the incoming president's hands by making policy changes in the final weeks, but he is still the president. Shouldn't he, if he wants to change policy, shouldn't he be able to do it as
well,
he sees fit?
He can change policy, he can make speeches. What he should not do is change America's policy 40 years at the United Nations. If the Security Council resolution goes through, it completely ties the hand of an incoming president. You can't undo a Security Council resolution. You can't take away a veto. And this Security Council resolution is an invitation to the International Criminal Court to go after Israel. It's an invitation to the BDS movement to start sanctioning Israel. It's a very, very bad resolution. And there's a big difference between an outgoing president making a speech and changing the policy, which can then be changed by the incoming president, and doing something permanent and irrevocable.
So that was Alan Dershowitz saying that this is permanent and irrevocable. You cannot undo what President Obama has just allowed to take place at the United Nations Security Council, no matter how positive the next president of the United States is towards Israel. Now, this is extremely important. It's something that we have been tracking at Watch Jerusalem for a number of years. Editor-in-chief of Watch Jerusalem, Gerald Flurry, he penned a piece last year entitled, "What Inspires President Obama's Relationship with Israel?" And he wrote it about this same time, right as Hanukkah was taking place, and the President Obama invited President Rivlin of Israel to the White House for a candle lighting ceremony. And yet, what we saw in that picture definitely didn't indicate the deep hatred that he had for Israel, that he has for Israel. And now we can see that. Now, the quip for that article says Barack Obama claims he has, quote, an uncompromising commitment to Israel, but does he? But does he? Now, I don't have the time to go through the contents of that article, but you need to, and I'll put it in the show notes so that you can read it. And it was written based on a determination that President Obama was acting in the same spirit of a historical figure that has led, or that led in the past, an unparalleled attack against the Jews. He's acting in that same spirit. Now, you need to go back and read that article. It has everything to do with Hanukkah as well. Now, I'd like to play for you a clip from John Bolton. He's, of course, the former ambassador of the United States to the United Nations, because it looks like not only did the United States not veto this bill, as they'd usually do, but they were actually colluding behind the scenes to ensure that this bill was actually voted on before President Obama left office. Here's the former ambassador, John Bolton, speaking on Hannity, which plays on Fox in the United States. This, again, was from Friday.
Here now with reaction is former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. and Fox News contributor, John Bolton. Thank you, Ambassador Bolton. Wow, big day at the U.N. So tell us, do you think that the U.N. Security Council colluded with the Obama administration to bring this vote today?
Well, I think certainly the sponsors of the resolution, the Egyptians, some of the others, some of the five permanent members of the council, including Great Britain, obviously had to consult with the Obama administration to tell them what was in the resolution so that it was sufficient for Obama to order an abstention. The United States could have killed this resolution by voting no. It did vote no on a very similar resolution in 2011. But this was, and you said it exactly right at the top of the show, this was a stab in the back against the Israelis. It was entirely predictable. I would say this for people in the pro-Israel community in the United States who defended Obama's Middle East policy over these last 8 years, that you should have seen this coming, and this is what you get for supporting Barack Obama.
Yeah, and this is a shot, I guess, this is at Israel, but also President Obama had a pretty contentious relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, I think it goes beyond the personal. I really think this was an effort to box the incoming Trump administration in, and it violates nearly 50 years of American bipartisan policy on the Middle East, going back to the iconic Resolution 242 after the 1967 war, which established the principle of land for peace. This resolution says basically Israel's occupation is illegitimate, therefore it has no land to give back in exchange for peace. Contrary to what the Obama administration has said, this puts a huge thumb on the scale against Israel. It does go to final status. It does affect Israel's security. It undermines it in profound ways. The consequences of this resolution are going to be felt for many, many years, all negative on Israel and substantially negative on the United States itself.
So we have entered a new period here in Israel's history. While they might have the support of the new American president, the world now has every right, according to the world's foremost governing body, the UN Security Council, to act against Israeli interest in the West Bank, or to act against Israel for what they see as Israel's breaking of international law in the West Bank. Now, I do want to go now to Fox contributor and Washington Post columnist Charles Krauthammer, because he puts this into significance, at least shows how impactful this resolution could be, not just for those settlements in the outlying areas of the West Bank, because most of the settlement growth that has taken place over these years is just in and around East Jerusalem or in East Jerusalem. It's not talking about mostly these settlements far off in different portions of the West Bank. It's even talking about this resolution about East Jerusalem and the Old City itself. The Old City itself. Notice what Mr. Krauthammer has to say.
What happened today is that the United States joined the jackals at the UN. That was a phrase used by Pat Moynihan, the great Democratic senator, the former U.S. ambassador, who spoke for the United States standing up in the UN and to resist this kind of disgrace. To give you an idea of how appalling this resolution is, it declares that any Jew who lives in the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem, the Jewish quarter inhabited for 1,000 years, is illegal, breaking international law, essentially an outlaw, can be hauled into the International Criminal Court or into national courts in Europe, which is one of the consequences. The Jewish quarter has been populated by Jews for 1,000 years. In the War of Independence in 1948, the Arabs invaded Israel to wipe it out. They did not succeed, but the Arab Legion succeeded in conquering the Jewish quarter. They expelled all the Jews, they destroyed all the synagogues and all the homes, and for 19 years, no Jew could go there. The Israelis got it back in the Six-Day War, and now it's declared that this is not Jewish territory. Remember, it's called the Jewish Quarter, but it belongs to other people, and any Jew who lives there is an outlaw. That's exactly what we supported. The resolution is explicit in saying settlements in the occupied territories and in East Jerusalem.
Now, for many of us watching this and seeing what's happening here, where Israel is losing its international legitimacy to even live in parts of the Old City, to even live in parts of East Jerusalem that it conquered and fought for and died for during the Six-Day War, and an international body here saying that, no, that's illegal. Now, that rings prophetic alarm bells for us for a number of reasons, but the main one being that we know that, according to prophecies in Zechariah, that half of Jerusalem is going to fall into Arab hands. It is. That's what Bible prophecy says. And to explain that, you can go to our prophecy page and look at that tab that talks about half of Jerusalem falling, because it is an important domino on the prophetic timeline in the lead up to the coming of the Messiah. So this is what this UN bill is all about. Now, I do want to go to Mr. Danny Dannon. He is the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, and his response to when this bill at the Security Council was passed, because he draws on historical events that have taken place at this time of year in Israel's history, and is hopeful that Israel can muster the same type of fighting spirit that they did back then to overwhelm this Security Council resolution. So here is Mr. Danny Dannon at the United Nations on Friday with Israel's response.
Mr. President, today is a dark day for this council. The resolution you just voted on is the peak of hypocrisy. While thousands are being massacred in Syria, this council wasted valuable time and efforts condemning the democratic state of Israel for building homes in the historic homeland of the Jewish people. We have presented the truth time and again to this council and implored you not to believe the lies presented in this resolution. By voting yes in favor of this resolution, you have in fact voted no. You voted no to negotiations. You voted no to progress and a chance for better lives for Israelis and Palestinians. And you voted no to the possibility of peace. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, addressing this very council 1 week ago, said that the UN has, and I quote, a disproportionate volume of resolutions, reports, and conferences criticizing Israel. This resolution today will be added to the long and shameful list of anti-Israel UN resolutions. Instead of charting a course forward, you are sending a message to the Palestinians that they should continue on the path of terrorism and incitement, that they should continue to hold their own people hostage, that they should continue to seek meaningless statements from the international community. The sad truth is that today's vote will be a victory for terror. It will be a victory for hatred and violence. By continuing to provide excuses for the Palestinians to avoid recognizing our right to exist, you are only maintaining the status quo. The world is undergoing great change, and the new Secretary General will soon assume office. I call on this Council to take this opportunity to turn a new page, put an end to the bias and obsession with Israel, stop this endless attempt to blame all the problems of the Middle East on the one true democracy in the region, and make clear to the Palestinians that the only way forward is to end incitement and terror and to enter into direct and meaningful negotiations with Israel. Just 2 months ago, UNESCO approved an absurd resolution denying the connection between the Jewish people and Jerusalem. Today, this Council, including many of the world's leading democracies, the beacons of liberty, voted to condemn the State of Israel. You voted to condemn the Jewish people for building homes in the land of Israel. You voted to ban us from building in our historical capital of Jerusalem, the heart and soul of the Jewish people. Read the resolution. Tomorrow night, Israel and the entire Jewish community around the world will celebrate the holiday of Hanukkah. Over 2,000 years ago, King Antiochus banished the Jewish people from our temple in Jerusalem and issued decrees trying to sever us from religion and our heritage. But we prevailed. The Jewish people fought back. We regained our independence and relit the menorah candles in the temples. I ask each and every member of this council who voted for this resolution, who gave you the right to issue such a decree, denying our eternal rights in Jerusalem? Would this council have had the nerve to condemn your country for building homes in your capital? Would you ban the French from building in Paris? Would you ban the Russians from building in Moscow? Would you ban the Chinese from building in Beijing? Would you ban the British from building in London? Would you ban the Americans from building in Washington? We overcame those decrees during the time of the Maccabees, and we will overcome this evil decree today.
And that was Danny Dannon, the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, responding to the UN Security Council vote. And it's just interesting, the history that he brings up there, talking about the Maccabees and the decrees that were against Israel back then, against the Jews back then. And those decrees, who were they given by? They were given by the king of the Seleucid Empire at the time, Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV, who tried to destroy Israel completely, tried to destroy the Jews, tried to get rid of the law of the Jews as well. And it looked like Antiochus Epiphanes was going to succeed at that, but for a few faithful leaders on the outskirts of Jerusalem that did start an uprising, and after 3 years were able to fight back this campaign by Antiochus Epiphanes reclaiming the temple. And that's why Hanukkah is celebrated today. Hanukkah, which we're in the middle of right now. We're at the very beginning of right now. And here we are, some 2,100 years later, and the United States president is allowing a bill to go through the UN which directly harms Israel, the Israeli state today, the Jews, those descendants of those Maccabees from 2,000 years ago. Now, Mr. Dannon is hopeful that Israel is able to overcome those decrees. Now, to know whether they are, or to know the seriousness of what's going on right now with this decree from the United Nations against Israel, you need to read that article I mentioned before, What Inspires President Obama's Relationship with Israel. Yes, President Obama is leaving office, but this resolution that's gone through, that's there to stay. And this will be his lasting legacy on the Jewish state.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.fm. Thank you for listening.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
This is Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.
Earlier this year, there was reports of a building, a palatial building dated to the era of King Solomon 3,000 years ago, having been discovered at the royal city of Gezer. And Haaretz wrote about this, stating that the monumental building dates to the 10th century BCE, the era associated with King Solomon, who's famed for bringing wealth and stability to the newly united kingdom of Israel and Judah. Now, I have with me Watch Jerusalem writer Christopher Eames. He's written on a piece on Gezer that we're hopefully publishing up on the website, watchjerusalem.co.il, either tomorrow or on Tuesday. It's a continuation of his series on the Bible buried, the Bible people's buried cities. And he had the opportunity to go and visit Gezer just this past week in preparation for this piece. Thanks for coming on the show and taking some of that time out of your schedule before you fly out of the country today, Chris.
Shalom, Brent. It's good to be here.
Well, before we talk about this series that you have up on Watch Jerusalem and specifically Gezer, I just wonder if you could speak a little bit how you first got involved in archaeology in Israel.
Okay, sure. I participated in a college program at Herbert W. Armstrong College in America, and they have a archaeology program there and a big connection to a prominent archaeologist here in Israel, Dr. Elat Mazar. And periodically from year to year or every few years, they'll have some digs sponsored in which some students will be sent over to help in those excavations with Dr. Mazar. And I had the privilege of being able to go along to those excavations. I went to a couple of them. The first one was on the Ophel. Both of them actually were on the Ophel area in Jerusalem. The first one for about 7.5 months, and then the second one the following year for about 2.5 months. And actually for that second one, I was able to function as an assistant supervisor on the excavation. So that gave me a unique window into the process of excavation and looking into all the dig maps and excavation maps and really looking into and being part of the details and excavating this area of Jerusalem.
So before then, you didn't really have an inkling or a desire to pursue archaeology, or is that something that you wanted to do?
Well, it is something that I've wanted to do. Archaeology more recently, I think like most young boys, I always wanted to dig up dinosaur bones from a really young age. And getting older and maturing, I think archaeology just has more of that interest because it's about human history, really important things to humans and human history itself, and looking where we've come from, where we're going, and still digging up dinosaur bones, I'm sure, would be something really interesting. But there was that little window into excavation from a really young age for me.
Okay, so you've started to write this series, The Bible's Buried Cities, on Watch Jerusalem, and I think you've written about 4 or 5 biblical cities so far. What do you recall? What prompted you to think that this was going to be something that would be beneficial on the website?
Well, the first idea for coming up with this series was seeing this archaeology page for the website, and obviously having my connection here to you, Brent, having the chance to write these pieces on archaeology for the website. And I thought, well, there's been some interesting finds coming out of Lachish lately. It's another tell talked about in my series. It was the first one I wrote about. And I never really thought about putting this whole series together one after the other. But upon completing that one, just on Lachish, the city mound there belonging to the Judahite kingdom, that really inspired me to go forth and to finish more articles on the series and to really just build it up, to this point it's come to Gezer. Gezer has been the recent one I've been working on. This is number 5 in the series. We'll see how far it goes, but I've just got a real interest for covering cities as a whole. And in a lot of websites, it's just smaller finds that are individually discussed. And I think Watch Jerusalem is a good platform to wrap up the entire city and look at the whole context within the city and those individual finds within the cities to be able to present that to the public.
So basically in this series, you look at the city itself through time, the different empires that come in and rule over that city, and then the wars that take place surrounding them, who they fall into or whose hands they fall into next. And you really document that along with the biblical history, obviously, most importantly, and just going to see how these cities and their different destructions and the buildings there relate very much to the Bible and the history as described there. So I understand that you did visit Gezer in preparation for writing this. First of all, how do we actually know that this is biblical Gezer? Because cities have names today that might not correspond, of course, to the ancient name. And what was your first impression on visiting the tell?
Okay, well, with regards to labeling this city as Gezer, this is about the easiest city, ancient city, in all of Israel to actually specifically point out. And there's a very specific reason for that. This was the first ancient city mound in Israel that was positively identified by inscriptions. And what I mean by inscriptions, dating to about the, I think, the 1st century BC, around the entire site of Tel Geza were found big rocks set into the ground. About 13 of them have been found with the inscription on it, "This is the boundary of Geza." And that's about as clear as you can get it, that this must have been Geza. This is the boundary of Geza. It was written in, I believe, Aramaic, Greek, and possibly ancient Hebrew script as well. I'm not too sure of that. But in 2 or 3 different languages, this is the boundary of Geza.
So it would be pretty helpful if other biblical sites had this identification as well.
Right, for sure. And this is undisputed, really, about Geza. There's other cities that have their different disputations as to whether or not they correspond with the biblical version of the city. But this one has been really clear, and there's been absolutely no dispute about this. Now, regarding traveling to Geza, I indeed was able to do that here recently. And it's just a really, really picturesque site there. It's in the Shephelah region. It's in the foothills of the Judean hills. It's a western fortress, so it guards that western plain leading to the Philistine lands, leading to the Mediterranean Sea there, just at the entrance to the hills in Judea. A huge amount of finds from all kinds of different periods. Really impressive to go there and to be able to see that, and a really big inspiration for writing the series on this.
So Geza features pretty heavily in the Bible as one of the main cities. It's mentioned, as most people know, from King Solomon's time. But what have excavations there at that tell brought up from the periods before Judah and Israel, before King Solomon?
Well, they've discovered quite a lot from before the time of King Solomon. Like a lot of these cities, obviously, there was a big establishment of civilization there before the Israelites got involved, before the Israelites entered the Promised Land. And so from around 2000, especially from 2000 BC to 1500 BC, you've got a really strong Canaanite presence in the land, as we expect, with the Israelites coming into the land and taking the city from the Canaanites. And again, there's a story to that with Geza. But anyway, you've got the strong Canaanite presence in the land, and a lot of archaeology has gone to show that. There's a row of massive standing stones there dating to the Canaanite period, up to about 10.5 feet tall, these massive standing stones of several tons, multiple tons. And that's debated as to whether that was Canaanite cult worship or if it was some kind of tribal alliance there. There's been child sacrifice evidenced at Geza from the Canaanite period. Also, a massive city gate there, made of stone, the foundation of it made of stone with a bricks, mud brick superstructure above it. That dates to that Canaanite period, around 500 years before the Israelites came, within that time frame.
So in your article, just for people listening, they'll be able to see pictures of these things, would they?
Yeah, they'll be able to see pictures of this. It'll all be laid out in time sequence in the article. It should explain it fully there. And then one other thing in particular dating to this pre-Israelite Canaanite period is the largest defensive tower of its type ever to be found dating to the Canaanite period has been found at Tel Geza. Massive defensive tower there.
Why is that important?
And that's important because it just shows that this city was extremely strongly defended, strongly built up. So this wasn't an easy city for the Israelites to come in and conquer. And we'll see that as we go through the story of how the Israelites entered the Promised Land, what happened at Tel Geza itself. And not just with this tower, but there were also strong, strong Canaanite walls. An inner wall were made of stones up to 13 feet long, and an outer wall that was about 3,600 feet long all the way around the city, a really strong 13-foot-thick outer wall, 3,600 feet long.
Wow. So Joshua, obviously, is leading the Israelites into the Promised Land after Moses' death, and he's got this blitzkrieg campaign, really, through Israel to take over these cities and of the Canaanites, and he must have been confronted with these massive walls and the massive fortifications there. So does the Bible talk about the way in which he destroyed Gezer, or does the Bible relate how Gezer was taken, or is that available in other sources?
That's partially available in the Bible sources and then partially in other sources. Now, as I point out in the article, we turn to the Amana letters and look at the connection there, the possible connection between the 14th century BC invasion of the Hebrew people and link that to the Hebrew people. And you can see that that connection there.
So just wait, before we move on, what are the Amana letters, just for our listeners?
Sure. The Amana letters are a trove of clay tablets, clay documents that were written from the leaders of the land of Canaan and were sent to the leader of Egypt. And these were found in Amana in Egypt. And these letters, they date to 1400 BC, around the time the Israelites would have been entering the Promised Land. And these are from Canaanite kings, absolutely terrified of these people, these nomads, they call them, who are invading the Promised Land, and they call them the Hebrew people. And it's interesting to look at the Bible. At this point in time in the Bible, most of the time, the Israelites are referred to as Hebrews rather than Israelites. That's something that surprised me. I only recently found that one out myself. So these Canaanite kings are absolutely terrified and calling to the leader of Egypt to help them against these nomadic, as they call them, Hebrew peoples who are just sweeping into the Promised Land. And I make that link there. We look into that link between the Hebrew people and the Hebrews with that time frame linking up perfectly as well.
So you've got Joshua coming into the land. You've got the local Canaanites there, trying to write to their Egyptian lord, basically, and saying, come and help us, right? And there were specific ones from the king of Gezer?
That's right. And I've got a couple of excerpts here. Maybe I can read one or two of them. From the king of Gezer, desperate king of Gezer, pleading with Egypt for help. And he says, "To the king, my lord," this is Egypt's pharaoh, "message of Yapahu, the ruler of Guzru." Now, this was the old name of Gezer, Guzru. It also comes up, the Assyrians call it Guzru as well. "Since the Hebrew are stronger than we, may the king, my lord, give me this help, and may the king, my lord, get me away from the Hebrew, lest the Hebrew destroy us." And there's a couple more of these letters, and as we see the progression of them, and we see a letter also from Jerusalem, by this point, the Jerusalem letter from the Jerusalem king says that Gezer has been taken by the Hebrew people. And now we look into the Bible record. The Bible doesn't necessarily specifically state that Gezer was taken, but it says the king of Gezer was defeated. And there's a long list of kings there in the book of Joshua, kings who were defeated. We know that the king of Gezer sent help to Lachish in defense with the king of Lachish. He was defeated. And from these letters, we can imply that Gezer itself also was defeated Gezer proper. Now, this gets a little bit different because as we get into the story of Joshua even more, we read that Gezer was conquered, but that the Canaanites were allowed to remain in the city. Gezer became a part of the tribe of Ephraim, but the Canaanites were allowed to remain in the city.
And that's something we really see throughout the period of the Judges, and even especially at the beginning of the book of Judges, you have the discussion of how different cities were taken throughout the land of Canaan by the Israelites, by Joshua. And then there were certain cities that were meant to be, continued to be taken by the tribes themselves after Joshua died. And yet a lot of them did not follow through on that. And Gezer, I guess, was one of them. So how was it that Israel then, after the initial time that they took the city, then lost the city back, I guess, to the Canaanites, when did they start to rule over this city?
Well, that's a bit of a story as well, because within the next 100 years, Egypt had actually come back in, were making raids into Canaan again once Israel was there, and then they destroyed Gezer. And then after that, the implication is that the Philistines actually came in, and we've got quite a thick layer of Philistine pottery. in the Gaza area, and the Philistines took over this Gaza area, and this actually relates to the time of Samson and his struggles during the time of the judges against the Philistines.
Which makes sense, right? Because he was of the tribe of Dan, and Samson was, and Dan and Ephraim, kind of this city of Gaza is kind of close to that border, right, between
right.
those two tribes?
It's right up close there, right on the border with between Ephraim and Judah, but also Ephraim and Dan and also the Philistines. So a real hot point location there, flashpoint location. So you've got the Philistines who have made this inroad into Gaza. And from what the Bible records, the Philistines actually hold the city up till David's time. There's a reference in 1 Chronicles about King David fighting the Philistines at Gaza. And then it seems that Gaza doesn't fully come under Israelite control until the time of King Solomon. And even then, it wasn't the Israelites that did this. It's really interesting.
So, I guess under King David, we think of David as the conqueror. Right, but it looks like he didn't conquer the city himself.
Right, it looks like that there was fighting against the Philistines. Perhaps a brief hold on Gaza by the Israelites, but by the time we reach Solomon, we see that Pharaoh has had to come in, the Pharaoh of Egypt, and besiege Gaza itself in order to give it to Israel, in order to give it to Solomon, because at that point Solomon had married the daughter of Pharaoh, and so Pharaoh thinks, what's a good gift for a girl? What's a good gift for my daughter? I'll go and conquer Gaza, which obviously then was under foreign hands, and we can assume that it was probably still under the hands of the Philistines. Perhaps further archaeological evidence will clear that up. But putting together what we know at the moment, it was under foreign hands, likely the Philistines. Pharaoh came in, conquered it, and gave it to Solomon, as we can see in 1 Kings. He gave it to Solomon as a gift because he had married his daughter, as a gift for Solomon and his wife.
So the Bible is pretty clear about, obviously, that history. But what does the archaeology tell us about that period in which, I guess, the city would have been destroyed by the Egyptians, but then also Solomon taking the city, and the Bible relates that Solomon started to build up this city. What type of archaeological remains are there at Gezer that testify to this?
The remains from what Pharaoh did at Giza, there's obviously quite a thick set of remains from the earlier Egyptian incursion. Not much at all has been found of what would have dated to the time of King Solomon with the Pharaoh of Egypt conquering the city. But what we do suddenly see is at this time of Solomon, the city has suddenly become under Israelite control. Now we ask, how did that happen? Obviously, it was this Pharaoh coming in, turning it over to Israelite control. And so starting partway into Solomon's reign, we do see a ton of archaeological evidence showing that suddenly this city came under strong Israelite control, and a lot of strong Israelite building was happening at the city. And there has, like you referenced the Haaretz article, there's a palace dating to King Solomon's time that was found there. Most significantly, there was a six-chambered gate dating to King Solomon's time. These have been very interesting gates found all around Israel dating to this 10th century Solomonic time. And it flies in the face of a theory that's been quite popular, saying that Solomon was just a legendary kind of tribal chieftain. He didn't really control much. But the fact that you've got these six-chambered gates, these gates with three chambers on each side, built in the same construction style over cities all across Israel, and specifically talked about in the Bible that Solomon built up Gaza, this one we've been talking about today, and Megiddo, and the third one, what was the third one?
Gaza, Megiddo, and one in the north, Hatzor.
And
you haven't done Hatzor yet, have you?
I haven't done Hatzor yet, so I apologize for that. But Jerusalem also is talked about there. There's a possible find of a six-chambered gate there in Jerusalem. But you've got these references in the Bible to Solomon building up these specific cities, and then in archaeology we found them built up the same way with these same style construction of gates. And we find that in Gaza, and it dates to the Solomonic period, and it shows a strong, united kingdom centered in Jerusalem with the strong leader that must have required that these cities be built the same way. So it goes to show that there was a strong leader dating to Solomon's time, and Solomon must have been, just as the Bible calls him, a strong, powerful, wealthy leader over Israel.
Okay, so obviously Solomon starts building up this city, has a builds a palace there right alongside the gate. You can see that if you go to Gezer today. They're continuing excavations at Gezer even into this next year, and they had a past season in 2016, which they uncovered right alongside this six-chambered gate, this palatial structure with a lot of obviously Israelite period pottery and finds such as that. So what happened after King Solomon? We know that the Bible describes it after King Solomon, you had the tribes of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, breaking off from the kingdom of Judah. Kingdom of the Judah would just be having under Rehoboam, Judah and Benjamin. The Levites would then go down over into Judah. So do we have anything more in the Bible, first of all, that talks about Gezer through this period? And then how does that match up with what's been discovered?
Well, Gezer has had a bit of a rough history, especially after this breaking off of the and separation of the kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, because it was a border city right on the border between the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Judah. When they broke off, obviously Gezer went to the northern kingdom, but it wasn't spared of the problems that also came with being a border town. And what archaeology has shown is a widespread Egyptian destruction again that same century belonging to King Solomon, about 925 BC, during the reign of Solomon's son Rehoboam, the king of Egypt, King Shishak. This is referred to in history, some believe it to be Pharaoh Shoshank the first. He came in to punish the southern kingdom, to punish the kingdom of Judah, and swept through, destroyed many cities, came and besieged Jerusalem itself, and basically besieged the city, conquered it, and then left, and enabled the Judahites to still live there. Now, what he also did was he also besieged Gezer, and there's been some evidence of that. And it looks like while he didn't besiege Israel as a whole, the Bible doesn't say that, archaeology doesn't say that, he made incursions into cities like Gezer right on the border. He must have thought, it's a close city, might as well go and destroy this one too. I've got my army here. And so that's what he goes and does. And so we've got these thick destruction layers dating to this time period after King Solomon, during the time of Rehoboam, Pharaoh Shoshank the First, King Shishak, as he's linked up with. And after this, you've got not quite as heavy of a population in Gezer, but still the Israelites continued to live there and function there. There's been some interesting finds dating to these periods, these intervening periods. And that carries on up to the Assyrian destruction.
What date was that?
Okay, so the date of the Assyrian destruction would have been the late 8th century, and specifically Gezer itself is believed to be around the 730s, 732 possibly. Of course, the entirety of the kingdom of northern kingdom of Israel was taken around 720 BC. But Gezer in particular was besieged in 732, and this was the earlier campaigns of Tiglath-Pileser III. I've probably butchered that name. The rest of the campaigns were accomplished by Shalmaneser. And so there is a specific verse in the Bible about the Assyrian campaign under Tiglath-Pileser III. This is in 2 Kings 15 and verse 29. So we see him making inroads into these Israelite cities. Evidence shows that he took Gezer. There is actually a victory plaque that was found in his capital building of Nimrod. And this shows the destruction of Guzru, or Gezer, as we know it as. The same reference made by the Canaanite kings before Israel came into the land. So we see from this depiction that shows battering rams coming against the city, that shows people, townsfolk upon the city walls actually surrendering to Tiglath-Pileser, to his forces. And we subsequently see that this king of Assyria took over Gezer and then evidently left. The city ended up, since it was so close to the border of the southern Judahite kingdom, it turned over to Judah's hands, and then of course, eventually Judah later on was taken by the Babylonians, and the land and the area of Gezer as a whole went to the Babylonians. But the significant destruction happened during that Assyrian time under Tiglath-Pileser.
Okay, so that's kind of probably where the Bible ends its discussion of Gezer. When we have King Hezekiah coming along, that's probably the period in which, after the Assyrian Empire under Sennacherib, or his army is defeated, or he has to go back with his tail between his legs back to Assyria, the kingdom of Judah expanded and then would have taken this under its rule. But I guess is there a Babylonian level destruction at Gezer? Do you recall?
Not that I can recall. Not one that's been specifically identified. It would have come under the influence of Babylon, obviously, and it had just prior to that actually been an Assyrian administrative city. Obviously, the whole area coming under Babylonian control, it would have felt that presence. But there's nothing specifically that I'm aware of, anyway, that has been found for any destruction there.
Well, it seems there's a lot already covered in this little segment here. I'm Brent Nachtigall, and we've been talking to Christopher Eames here. He's a part-time archaeologist in Jerusalem. He worked as a supervisor on Eilat Mazar's excavation in the Ophel, and you can look for his article on watchjerusalem.co.il over the next couple of days. It's entitled "The Bible's Buried Secrets Tell Gezer." Thanks for coming on the show with us, Chris.
Been a pleasure.
Well, that brings us about to the end of our program today for watchjerusalem.co.il. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @watch_Jerusalem. You, of course, can write us snail mail if you like to go that route, and you can check that out on the contact page on Watch Jerusalem. Thanks again for listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.